My name's Derek. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
y'all. I'm so grateful to be up here. I'm grateful that Alex has asked me to be able to tell my story up here and being able to tell my story of really of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm so grateful to be in this program with Alcoholics Anonymous that I, like, get to have this opportunity. I get to share my story, right, you know, from where I was not too long ago to where I am today. And just to be at, like, this point in time, like, I still get nervous. It's just, like, changed from, like, where it was, like, when I first started telling my story. Because I think about when the first time I told my story, I was like, for, like, days, like, before I told my story. And I was, like, so anxious because I'm, like, I'm thinking about me, right? And so, like, and then to get up here and it's, like, been, like, now it's, like, a few, like, maybe, like, an hour before. And it's, like, it's gotten a little bit closer. And I think about a lot about recovering that same way is like where it kind of like shortens where things get like less in between. Like I start meeting like character defects and stuff like that. Like where it kind of gets less and less in between. But yeah, some house cleaning. My sobriety date is 11/02/2021. I just celebrated 4 years of recovery. That's impressive. I've been impressed with numbers greater than 3 and less than 5. Yeah, I have a sponsor and they know that they're my sponsor. I also have sponsees. I sponsor other men in this program, and I'm also able to, yes, and so my sponsor has a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. My home group is the Morning Potential Young People's Group in the Buford area at Serenity House. It's been my home group now for about 2 years. Very good young people's group. We're just a bunch of people who are on fire about Young People Alcoholics Anonymous and being able to share that message too. Definitely coming in young, it's like one of those things where it's just like being able to have that group of people where I can just be able to just connect, you know, connect with. So yeah, getting into my story. So I grew up in Lawrenceville, Georgia, you know, Gwinnett County. I was born to two people, my mother and my father. I'm named after my father, and he basically is he's from Philly. My mom's also from Philadelphia in New Jersey, and they moved down here, so they've been down here for over 30 years. I was born about 23 years ago. So I was born in 2002. That was pretty cool. And yeah, so I was born. My sisters, I have two older sisters. One sister is 16 years older than me. The other sister is 7 years older than me. And pretty spaced out in how big of the difference is, because it's like 16 years and then there's like 7 years. And it's a pretty big difference. So the experience we had was that it felt as though we all felt like we were all kind of doing our own thing. It was like this experience where we all almost felt like we were only children because we were so spaced out. We all had different experiences, as we had different experiences with our parents, too. We had different experiences with our parents because we were at such different points. Our parents were at different points. Like, my mom had my sister at a very young age, and for that whole experience of, like, when I was born, too. And so, whole thing going on. And yeah, so I would tell you, I was born in a middle class household, and I would say my life, I would say whatever normal is. I don't really describe it as normal because there was this one thing that really affected me is that I didn't have a relationship with my dad in the way that I wanted him to be there for me. Like, I felt like he was a provider, I felt like he was a protector, but I never really felt like he was really a dad to me. I wanted him to show up for my extracurricular events, and he didn't really show up for me in that way. So I thought, another thing that made me think how I felt was that I felt like I was less than. I felt that because my dad didn't want to show up to all my events and stuff, that there was something wrong with me, that there was less than, that I felt like I wasn't worthy enough, that I was not enough. So that's the feeling that I had from a young age because my father didn't show up for me in that way that I wanted him to, when I wanted him to show up as a dad to me. And I thought he was just that provider and that protector, right? And so I had this whole experience and you know, jumping into like elementary school, I remember going into kindergarten, and I had another experience where I was in kindergarten and I was struggling with learning. And I was struggling with learning, and there was like this difficulty with me to be able to learn different things. And this learning thing that I kind of struggled with was they had identified that I had dyslexia. So that I had dyslexia. So basically, I struggled with my letters. Always got them confused. Always said the wrong thing. And teachers would tell me, even like as I grew up through my whole school experience, was that teachers would tell me, "Why don't you stay after school and get some extra credit?" Right? And every time they said something like that, the thing I heard in my head was, "I'm not enough. I'm stupid. You told me to get extra credit. You told me, why don't you stay after for some tutoring? why don't you do something like that? Hey, we'll help you get you some extra support. And every time I heard that was that I heard in my head that I'm stupid. I didn't hear that I just might have needed some extra assistance, some extra support. And so I thought about this whole thing for such a long time, is where I had this old idea, like it says in the book, right? I had this old idea about myself that I'm stupid, I'm not enough. And that's even what I walked into these rooms with and even stuck with in these rooms with, and for at least the first year or two. And so, you know, jumping into that, got into middle school. And so if I could describe myself, I was very shy. Like, that was my personality. Very shy. I was uncomfortable in my own skin. I was awkward. Didn't know how to talk to people. I'd like hide from people. I'd be like, ooh, don't talk to me, you know. Like, and that was the experience. And then they'd be like, no, he's shy, but like, you talk to him for a little bit, he'll open up to you a little bit, you know. And that was like how I was. I was like, after I get to know you a little bit, then I open up to you. Originally, though, I was just very like pulled back. And that was the experience that I had, right? And so, but in middle school, I went to a different middle school than I went to a high school. I went to a different middle school than I went to an elementary school. So I had an opportunity to meet new people. I got to be able to say, well, I get to try out new things. I get to, you know, be a different Derek, you know? So I tried out for, I was in The Wizard of Oz. I was like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. So like I was like singing in the play. That was pretty cool, you know? I ran from class president. So like I ran for eighth grade class president. I did flyers and stuff around the school, ended up winning class president. Only reason I think I won is because I told everybody I'd give them free chips every day, you know, and like just like the whole thing. And like I did all those things while at the same time, I thought if I did these things, maybe it would make me feel like I'd feel like enough. If I did these things, maybe I'd get this feeling of this worthiness, right? And so I had this whole experience where I kept doing these things. And I even did, like, in high school, did team captain in sports, all this stuff, was able to succeed in that way. Well, just feeling still doing all these things because I thought you'd like me more if I did these things. I thought if I did these things, then you'd like me if I did all these things. So, first time I got loaded. So, so there's this thing called a quinceañera. So, quinceañera is a 15-year-old girl's birthday party, basically. And she, like, turns 15. They throw a whole big party, a big celebration. So, it was one of this, like, it was, like, one of the popular girls in school. And, like, she invited me to her quince, along with, like, I don't know, like, 200 other people invited. And I was like, man, this is an amazing thing. This is pretty cool. So, I get there, and me and my boy, he's, like, one of my friends, we had gotten some like edibles. So we got these edibles, these little brownies things, and when we got them, we had them already with us. And so next to the banquet hall where the quinceañera was being hosted at, there was a Dollar Tree next door. So there's this Dollar Tree next door, and we were like, let's eat the edibles in the Dollar Tree. So we walk into the Dollar Tree, we go inside the Dollar Tree, we're walking down the aisles. We see, we're eating them. Like, we're just trying to be, like secretive and stuff. Like, I mean, like, they're not really smelling. It's just, we were trying to be secretive because we didn't want anybody to find out, right? You do that, we eat the edibles, and then we go back into the vent hall that's, like, next door. So we go back next door, and then I sit at one of the round tables. I have, like 8 or 10 round tables, good amount of people, a lot of people dancing on the dance floor. And so I sit at one of the round tables, and when I sit down, I'm sitting there for like maybe in the gaze, like around like 10, 15 minutes, and then like boom, it like hits. And like that experience that I feel is like I feel comfortable in my own skin. I feel like whatever had been wrong had felt like it had been righted. Like my whole life, whatever had felt like would have been wrong, I felt like it had just been righted in that moment. And I had this experience where like I felt a part of. I felt like I wasn't worried about what other people were thinking about me anymore. I felt comfortable in my skin. Like, it was just this amazing experience. I felt like it's bliss. And, like, this is an amazing experience. And this whole thought that came to me afterwards was like, I was like, man, what y'all been holding this out for me? Like, y'all been holding this out for me for such a long time. Like, who knew this stuff existed? Like, this experience like this where I could feel like me and feel okay for what I thought was me. And that was so cool, right? And so I'm still at the quinceañera. I try and get up and dance. That didn't go too well. And so this whole thing, you know, I remember just afterwards, like, just falling in love. Like, just falling in love with alcohol. And this experience was just, like, alcohol and substances were, like, my thing. That was my jam, right? And so I kept doing that over and over. And eventually my parents found out. and they saw that my grades were dropping. They saw my grades were dropping, and they were like, hey, well, look, like, we're going to start drug testing you. We're going to start watching you. Like, you can't be going out the house at this time and this time. Like, we're going to start, like, paying close to mine. My parents, we have alcoholism. It runs in our family. Like, it's kind of, like, a little bit distant. It's, like, on my mother's side and a little bit on my dad's side. While my mother and my father, not their experience. They did not experience drugs or alcohol. That was not their experience. So, for me, it was, like, their first experience with, like, a kid who was doing something like this. And so, they just knew what to do. They were doing the best they could with the information that they had. Right. So, you know, they were drug testing me, doing this for like 3 months. During this 3 months, mom had encouraged me. She said, I want you to go on this Christian retreat. Go on this Christian retreat. And while I'm on this retreat, I remember they told everybody while we were on this Christian retreat, because I didn't want to go, but my mom was like, you need to go to this. You need to get connected to God, and this will help you. And they put me in therapy, and that was cool. I just talked to the dude, and eventually he was just like, I don't even think you got a drug problem. And I was like, okay, cool, yeah. I was like, yeah, man, I've been sober for like 3 months. So I'm at this Christian retreat thing, and they tell everybody, they say, go outside and connect to God. So I go outside, and I walk down a hill. When I walk down this hill, there's this bench, there's a lake right next to it, and then there's this tree that's right over the bench. And it's a big tree. And I get and I sit on the bench right underneath that tree. And when I sit on that bench, I start praying for like the first time intentionally. And I was sitting there and I was praying and I was like, God, if you're there, give me a sign. And I felt for the first time, it was like the wind started blowing on me and I was like, I was like, felt like I was having some sort of like spiritual experience. I was like, oh my gosh. Right? And it was for the first time I felt this sense of like, I felt a sense of peace wash over me when in that moment. It was pretty cool. I still ended up getting drunk about like a month later. So I can't have experiences like that if I don't have anything to maintain that. Like, I can't have experiences like that if I don't have a program to be able to maintain those spiritual experiences. So I'm back to like drinking again, back to smoking again. This is really when alcohol is like started taking like a really big piece of my life too. And so like I'm drinking and smoking and doing other things. And just, I kept doing that and just kept doing it. And I started working at about like 18 as a bartender. So I worked as a bartender at a restaurant. And I'm like 18, 19. And working as a bartender while I'm there, you know, every time they're like, throw away the drinks. I'm like, I'm not throwing away the drinks. I'm going to drink the drinks. Like, that's what I'm going to do. Like, that makes sense to me. Like, I'm going to drink the drink. So, you know, every time they're like, throw it away, I'm like, I just run to the back and just drink it. And then I come back. Yeah. So, all that stuff, doing all that, was like something I just kept on doing while I was working there. And this is where I kind of found like a more of a liking to alcohol. Like, I started to enjoy alcohol a little bit more, right? And during this time, so I have this friend. He was my best friend. Yeah, he was my best friend. Basically, we grew up together. And I remember in kindergarten, me and him were friends around that time. And then we really, like, good friends, like, best friends, say around, like, first or second grade. And during this time, I remember my grandmother, when we were in, like, first or second grade, was like, you guys look after each other, you know? Like, that was, like, because she worked at the school that we both went to. She was one of the cafeteria workers. And so she worked at the school, and she was like, you guys take after each other, you know? Like, look after my grandson, like. And that's what she told my other friend, and my best friend at the time. And we were, like, first or second grade. We ended up going to different middle schools, and then we came back into high school, and then in high school, we were, like, boys again, you know? Like, we was like, yo! You know, like, it was, like, this whole experience. We were, like, best friends again. It was this whole experience. And we eventually both started, like, drinking and smoking and doing all those things. Yeah, it was just a whole experience where something happened, and I had basically said something to him. And he was like, well, he was like, I said, man, well, what you going to do about it? And he was like, all right, man. He was like, well, that's you a little. And I was like, I don't like that you call me names. And then he was like, nah, man, did all this whole stuff. And then I was thinking in my head, once he called me that name, I was like, next time I see this dude, I'm going to fight this dude. So I had this experience where I was like, all right, next time I see him, I'm going to fight this dude. And so I find out, like, he's with one of our friends one night, and I'm like, all right, cool, I'm going to go and see him. Like, I'm already playing in my head, I'm going to go fight this dude. So I pull up, they're hanging out with my other friends, he's there, he's in the car right now, so he's in his Mustang, I get out of my minivan, I'm walking over to the car, and while I'm there, I'm talking to him. And I'm like, what's up, man? He's like, what's up? And I'm like, come on, bro, you can't be calling me names. He's like, all right, bro, let me get out the car. So he gets out the car. He goes to his trunk. He grabs his shoes out the trunk. He starts changing his shoes. So I'm sitting there patiently waiting. And while he's changing his shoes, and the whole time I'm just like, okay. And then we're like, he's like, all right, I'm ready. So he walks, like walking down a hill, walking down this hill. It's like some concrete hill. And like it's really like a street. So we're walking down the street, and we're like stopped like halfway through. And he's like, what's up, man? I'm like, what's up, man? You call me names? He's like, you call me a little. And he's like, well, you don't see why I called you a little? And I was like, no, I don't. Like, I don't like that you call me names. And then he was like, nah, man. He was like, man, you don't get it. It's like the stuff you're doing. And I was like, man, nah, man. And he was like, man, you ain't trying to fight for real. And I was like, and so he turned around and walked away. And I was like, okay. So that whole experience was like, all right. So fast forward a few days later, I'm sitting there, and I'm in my room at my house, and I'm like, bro, if I ever see him again, I ain't gonna talk to him. Yeah. You know, like I'm gonna get him. And then a few days after that, I get a text from a random phone number. Well, not from a random phone number, from one of his cousins. And I found out that he had gotten killed by a drunk driver. I thought about that experience. It left me with a lot of guilt. It left me with a lot of shame. Because I felt like that experience was something I couldn't have made right. I didn't feel like I had the opportunity to make it right. And I felt like we were left at the middle of us having an altercation where we weren't able to make it right. What I've learned from that experience is this. Is that the way I feel today is that I never would have thought I'd feel as good as I do today. Like as good as I feel today, this happy, joyous, and free I feel today in sobriety. When I was going through that then, I didn't think I'd feel as good as I do today. And I didn't think that would ever change the way I was feeling then. So I felt that guilt, that shame, whole thing, in for like at least like another like three more months. I was still going through it. I started working this night shift job, and while I was working this night shift job, I was barely getting any sleep. Worked there for about a month. This was like 2 months after he had passed away. And while I'm working there, I'm just not getting any sleep, and I'm still feeling guilty, I'm still feeling shameful. I'm just in this dark place, and during this time, I'm still drinking, I'm still using. Drinking had really even started becoming more of a part of my like routine, right? And while I'm doing that stuff, it's like I can't get high enough. I can't get drunk enough. It's like the alcohol had ceased to work in my life like it did before. And while I kept drinking, it like didn't work anymore. And so I felt so hopeless. I felt like I was just in this dark place. And while I was in this dark place, I decided one day, I was like, all right, well, I'm going to take some acid. So I took some acid, went to my parents' house. So I'm at my parents' house. I go to my parents, and they're like, what's going on? And they're like, I'm like, I don't know, I took some acid. They're like, what? they're like, well, we're going to send you to rehab. And I was like, oh, okay. So this whole experience was like, my experience with like that, my parents brought me into recovery before I had the realization, this is what I have to do if I want to stay in recovery. Just my experience. I get to rehab while I'm in rehab. And during that time when I came home, I told them all the drugs I've been doing. They found all my empty bottles that I had around the house. They were like, oh my gosh. So go to rehab. At rehab, while I'm there, I stay there for like a day or two. And then I'm like, all right, it's like up in like North Georgia. So like it's in the middle of nowhere. And so like, I'm like, I run away like on the second day. And when I run away on the second day, I realize like I'm in the middle of nowhere. So I come back to the rehab. And then like on the third day, I'm like, all right, let me chill. I'm like, I'm good. Then on the fourth day, I try to run away again. And I realize I'm still in the middle of nowhere. So I come back to the place. And so then I'm still there. And then I run into somebody that I used to know that, like old person I used to deal with, like somebody who was related to somebody who I knew back in my past. And it kind of scared me a little bit. So I was like, all right, bro, I got to get out of here. I got to find some way to get out of here. Didn't know how, but I was just thinking, I was like, all right. There was like the same night, on the fifth night, I was basically going to, we're getting ready to go to sleep. And when we're getting ready to go to sleep, my roommate was like, hey, man, he was like, don't try and hurt yourself. And I was like, he's telling me I need to hurt myself. So I was like, I don't know what I was thinking. It was going through my head. I was like, he's telling me I need to hurt myself so I can be able to leave. So I grab this flashlight that I have. I have this flashlight, and it breaks windows. So I go up to this, like, this window, and it's on the second story. So it's inside of my room. I'm on the second story in my room, and I smash it on the glass. I smash on the glass, and then I jump through the window. And when I jump through the window, I land on my feet, and I fractured my left foot. So I fractured my left foot. Ooh, yeah. Then I run around about, like, say about, like, 50 feet, maybe 100 feet, and run all the way down to the med bay at the bottom of the rehab. It's, like, down in the basement. So I get down there, and then I'm talking to one of the nurses, and the nurse is like, what's going on? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, they're like, well, if you don't, like, they're going to send you somewhere else. Like, they're going to send you somewhere worse than just rehab. And I was like, okay. They were like, I was like, I don't know. Maybe I took some acid. And then so then they were like, okay, well, that might work. And then the EMTs come, police officer comes. They're, like, strap me down. They're, like, fighting with me. So they strap me down. And eventually they get me to the hospital, get to the hospital. While I'm there, I'm put on the 1013 hold. On this 1013 hold, while I'm there, I had this thought. I'm like, it was like the second day while I'm in there, I have this thought. Because I looked in the mirror. And when I looked in the mirror, I didn't know what was looking back at me anymore. I had that feeling of just being hopeless. And I didn't know what to do. I thought it was the end of the road. That was the end of my life. And that was it. And truly, when it's like how it says in Bill's story, how dark it is before the dawn and how dark it is before the light comes up. When the sun comes up at the beginning of the day, how dark it is right before it. So I had this whole experience, you know, I'm doing all that. I remember my nurse was watching over me while I was on that 1013 hold, and she happened to be 30 years plus in recovery. I call that coincidence or godsidence. I don't know. One thing I asked her, I said, do you have any advice for me? And the only thing she told me to do was to get a sponsor. And so this is like the first thing I did. I went to rehab again. And this time I stayed, got a sponsor, all those things. End up doing the steps, going through that. And so this is kind of something I like to do when I tell my story. I usually like to go through the steps and kind of like break it down through that. So yeah, I came into recovery at 19 years old. Came into recovery at 19. The old timers were like, man, I spilled my liquor and you drink. And so then I'd be like, well, maybe can you spill so much you would have got here quicker, you know? And like this would be the whole experience of what I had is that I saw the differences, not the similarities. And I was told this, is that you compare your way out of Alcoholics Anonymous and you identify your way into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had this whole experience where I was able to identify my way in, but I still felt like I was different than y'all, right? And I did realize this about like step one. Step one is realizing is that I'm screwed. So that means I got no other options. I got to go through with the rest of the work. And this whole experience, my step one experience was when I came home and I told my parents and they found out about all my empty bottles. And when they found out about all those empty bottles and everything I'd been doing, that felt like for me was like that point where I was just the axe up. And I tell you this, it's not about how much I used or what I used that make me an alcoholic. It's about what happens to me when I'm not drinking and when I am drinking that makes me an alcoholic. Because when I stop, I'm just thinking about it. And when I start, don't know how to stop. That's a little experience. And I had this experience with step two. So step two was one of those experiences where I felt as though, I went to church as a kid, but I never felt like I could really connect to God. I felt like I just went to the church, but I felt like the pastor, everybody else could connect to God, but I didn't feel like I could ever really have a relationship with God. So I had this whole experience where if you're struggling with the God concept, when I came here, I had the gift of desperation. That's G-O-D. That means I was willing to do whatever y'all told me to do to be able to stay sober. And then I came to y'all. Y'all were a group of drunks. That's G-O-D. Y'all, the people Alcoholics Anonymous are already sober. And then y'all gave me some good, orderly direction. That's G-O-D. You gave me some suggestions on how I can be able to live my life sober today. And when I did all those things, eventually I developed this relationship with this higher power. And today I have this intimate relationship with God, like who I choose to call God. I have this intimate relationship where I never really feel like I'm quite alone. I feel connected to something. Sometimes I can't even put a name on it because it's just so big in my life. And I had this connection to something today. I did all that. I think about like step three. And when I get to like step three, I remember this speaker. It was his last talk. When he was doing his last talk, he talked about it's easier to get an alcoholic to quit drinking than it is for him to quit playing God. And I thought that was like profound. I thought that was so cool. Because for me, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I drop my alcoholism off. Turn that over to God. Don't want to give him my relationship issues. Don't want to give him my financial issues. And eventually, I got to turn everything over. Like, my alcoholism is just that beginning process. And eventually, I got to turn everything over to my higher power. Right? And how do I know that I've done a thorough third step? It's by taking that fourth step. And so when I do that four step, right, I'm doing that four step, and when I do that, I start to see, for me, it was a big thing. I felt disconnected from people for a long time. For one, is that when people got close to me, I'd push you away, because if you felt like if you got to know me, then you wouldn't like me. So I pushed you away, and I hurt you first before you could hurt me. And I did this, and this showed up my inventory. What showed up my inventory was that I had patterns. There was things that I kept doing over and over that kept showing up in my inventory. And I tell guys this is when I'm taking them through their inventory, it's like bringing a mirror up to their face. For the first time, they get to see a right-sized view of who they are. They get to see the good, the bad, and the ugly all at once. That's what happens when they do that four-step inventory. Remember when I was doing my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor, doing it, it was almost like I was like, while he was listening, he was like, he just got up and got a cup of coffee. I'm like, pour my heart out. And like, you just got up and got a cup of coffee. So this is all experience and stuff, but that's the thing, right? Coming to AA, and there's nothing new for these people, right? And it was pretty cool. And then I get into like my sixth and seventh step. And that's been a big thing for me lately, has been six and seven. Because I think about now, this whole experience has been with those two steps has been this, is that I believe it's like character defects are like the spot it, you got it. Usually if I can spot the character defect, I usually got it too, right? And this whole experience with this is that I think about my sponsor was telling me, we were having some conversation, he was like, sounds like you're saying you're unworthy. He was like, I want you to share that in a meeting. So I go into a meeting, and I share in the meeting, I'm like, I feel like I'm unworthy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel like people in AA are going to find out I'm not who they think I am. I feel like I'm a fraud. And some lady comes up to me after the meeting, and she says, you are worthy. And what you have to say does have value. And I was like, this lady's being a pain in my ass. And I was like, all right. So whole experience for me was like a big thing, seeing my worth and knowing that I am worthy. Right? I talked about early on in my stories that I didn't feel like I was enough. And coming into AA, I still didn't feel like I was enough. And that was like the biggest thing for me, is like knowing my worthiness. So I do this whole thing, and now it's like I'm a, what's it called? And this is not too long ago. I remember me and some friend were talking, and hopefully I put this the right way. I got to be vulnerable with this person. And when I did, it was like I got to respond in a different way than I had before. Like then I thought was possible, right? And when I got to respond, it was like, oh my gosh, right? And that's why I tell you, is like these character defects don't just go away. Like I don't just wake up one day and be like, oh my gosh, my character defect got removed. All right. And then I just go on with the rest of my day. It's like I respond differently in a situation than I had before. And that's when I realized that character defect has been removed by my higher power. And when that happens, I have this whole experience where now, afterwards, a day after that experience where I was sharing that with that friend, I felt like I was crying on the way to work because it felt like that little boy had been healed inside. And like, that's the experience I get today. And now I have this like calm feeling that I walk around with. Like, I feel like I'm just going to be okay. Like, no matter what happens, good or bad, like, I'm just going to be okay. My higher power is looking out for me, right? And I get this experience in AA. And now it's like jumping into like 8 and 9. Ooh. Before I get to 6 and 7. So there's also this. It's like when I said the spot it, you got it. You know, I like to think about it, not always just the character defect. What if it's the character asset in somebody else that I see? Like what if I see that somebody has kindness in them? Maybe I see a little bit of that just reflecting off of me too. Or maybe I see that somebody's charismatic. Maybe just a little bit of that is reflecting off of me too. Right? And that's the thing, is like the spot it, you got it can also be I see the character asset in someone else. That's also in me too. So getting into 8 and 9, my dad, he was never really around for me. I felt like he was a provider, a protector. Never really felt like he was a dad to me. And so me and him always butted heads. And I remember the day he dropped me off at detox. The day he dropped me off at detox was, and my dad comes from that Macho Man era where like men don't cry. Like they don't cry. And so I think about the day he dropped me off at detox, it was the first time I seen him have tears in his eyes. And that's to tell me, is my addiction only just affecting just me, or is it affecting other people too? So fast forward, my dad, this is like when I was about 13 months sober, I quit smoking, did all that, and we both quit at the same time. Reason we quit at the same time is because he started to have health issues. He had gotten chronic kidney disease. When he got chronic kidney disease, the whole thing popped up, and I had to take him to the hospital that night, and basically we were there, and I was like, they were talking about this. We just knew at that point in time he had to quit smoking, I had to quit smoking, and something had to change for all both of us, because I didn't want to go down that path either, and already seeing the way it's affecting him. So I quit smoking. This was 3 years ago. Doing that, some doctor had came in while he was there for a few days in the hospital, and while some doctor came in, and while we were there, my dad was talking to the nurse, one of the doctors that came into the room. And so she was talking to us, and she was talking to me. She was like, you know, just doing a small talk. She was talking to me. She was like, your son, he's not in college. He should be in college. He should be doing this. He should be doing that. And then my dad, he confidently looked at the lady, and he was like, I'm not worried about my son anymore. Because this is just like, it sort of tells you, it's like what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. It doesn't just change me. It changes the people around me. My recovery affects more than just me. Recovery affects the people around me. And so, you know, fast forward, my dad took care of himself. He quit smoking. We haven't smoked any cigarettes for the last 3 years. Amazing thing. He started eating right. He started exercising. He was on the transplant list. The numbers got so good, he got taken off of the transplant list. He's healthy now. He's doing all these things. And, like, my dad is just killing it. Like, he looks up to me now. Like, he's like, man, you know, you're my motivation. I'm like, Dad, you did it, man. And that's so cool. Like, and so Dad's doing great now. And my parents now, they're, like, two of my best friends. Like, he's one of my best friends I can come to and talk to about whatever today. Like, he's somebody I can connect with today. I can share different things that are going on in my life, and he understands. And that's the beautiful part. That's the beautiful part, is that my relationships have changed with people today. So I get to, like, step 10. When I get to step 10, I think about this. It's like step 10 is a whole thing where it talks about a pause for the day. We pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought for the day. And I think that's such a big thing, is knowing when to pause. Because sometimes a pause can be like doing a prayer, going to a meeting, just stopping in the moment. I think it's taking some sort of action between my next thought and my next response. Just my experience. My character defects come out when I'm driving, man. You know? Like, you know, I used to get the middle finger, not get the peace sign. And, you know, I used to have the experience where, you know, somebody could cut me off in traffic. And they cut me off in traffic, I'd just be pissed off. I'm like, oh, this person just cut me off. Or I could be like, start thinking, I'm like, man, this person might be like on the way to they're having their baby. Like, it's the first baby, they're going to the hospital. And they cut me off in traffic so they could get to that baby. Like, and then my whole perspective changes on the person. And now I start rooting for the dude. Now I'm like, give me, you gotta go, man. Give me, you gotta go. And I'm like rooting for the dude. And so now it's like, it's just my perspective has to keep on changing, especially like as I'm still sober. I get to like step 11. And when I'm at step 11, I think about this prayer and meditation. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me, if you know how to worry, then you know how to meditate. And I think that's pretty cool. I came here and prayer was something I had to do consistently. Like a day-to-day thing was where like I built up this connection, this conscious contact, right? And so when I built up this connection, it was like I just had to do like small prayers sometimes. And doing those small prayers got me through the moments. And like now I still do small prayers. Like I don't think it has to be some complex thing is when I'm praying. It can be some simple thing, just saying a quick prayer before I go into the work, before I go into my job, anything like that. And those are the things that like get me through the day. I don't know if prayer changes things, but prayer changes me. And that's been pretty cool. And so I've had this experience where, you know, I get to like step 12. When I get to step 12, I think about when I was at this job workshop. When I was at this job workshop, I saw this guy. He was answering some of the questions. And when he was answering some of the questions, I just did not like this dude. I didn't like the way this dude was talking. I didn't like the way this dude was looking. I just did not like this dude. And something told me, go get up and talk to him. So I get up and I go talk to him. And I'm asking him questions. And really, it's about me while I'm up there, but I'm asking questions about him. And while I'm talking to him, I'm like, hey, he's like, I'm an inventor. He's like, I got 7 different products in Walmart. I've been in recovery for the last 15 years. God is maybe the person I was always meant to be. And I was like, whoa. I walked away from that conversation and was like, yo, that dude's like embodiment of like somebody who was really cool. Like, I would have liked to be somebody like that. Like, and I would have missed out on an opportunity to meet somebody so cool because I had these preconceived notions about somebody before even getting to know them. So that was pretty cool, right? I had this experience where there was some newcomer at the meeting. And when I saw him at the meeting, I saw him there, he basically was like, I could just see on his face. Like, I see that he's new. Like, you just see it because I've been there. I've been there and looking in the meeting, not knowing what's going on. You know, they seem, everybody's laughing, everybody's joking. I don't know what's funny. And I seen him through the meeting. And when I seen him there, went up and talked to him, got his number. And so I called him. Called him like a couple days later. And so I called him. And so we're talking about stuff. And then I'm like, you got a sponsor yet? He's like, no, my sponsor needs to be this, this, and this. I was like, okay, cool. So call him a week later. I might talk again. We're like, hey, man, you got a sponsor yet? You know, my sponsor needs to be this, this, and this. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm like, we're talking about other stuff, too. And then I call him a week later after that. I'm like, hey, man, you got a sponsor yet? He's like, no, my sponsor needs to be this, this, and this. He's just like, oh, man. He's like, I was like this. I was like, so is it your first time in recovery? He said, yeah. I said, so how do you know what you need and what you don't need? Reason I asked him that question is not to put him on blast, but be able to get him to start thinking, maybe I don't know anything about this recovery thing, right? Fast forward with that same dude. I saw him at a meeting, and when I was at this, I keep saying meeting lately. I don't know what that is. I was at a meeting. I was at a meeting, and when I was at this meeting, I was there. And while I was there, I basically was, I saw him there, and I gave this lady a hug. And he came up to me afterwards. He was like, can I get a hug? And I was like, yeah, bro, I don't know you like that, man. And like, no, but like, I was joking with him. Like, if you know me, you know I'm a hugger. Like, I'm a hugger. Like, I really am. And like, I was just joking with the dude. And then like, he called me afterwards. I was on my way home, and he was like, man, you just don't disrespect me like that. Like, you just gonna say that? Like, you're not gonna do that? And I was like, man. He was like, where you from, man? I was like, Lawrenceville. He was like, bro. He was like, yo. And he was like, man, I just don't like the way you treat me like that. Whole experience doing all that. And then he talks to me on the phone. And then I tell him this. I said, look, you can hate me, but don't hate Alcoholics Anonymous. He's like, look, you hate me, don't hate this program. And yeah, so that was the last time I saw that dude. Didn't see him at a meeting again. And there was something I learned from that experience, though. What I learned from that experience was that I can't just treat anybody any way I want. It means it's like I have to be able to present myself in a certain way. That means that even though that means coming in, there's people looking up to me. And I don't mean just me. I mean, like, even the person who has 30 days in this program, there's a person with one day who's looking up to that person with 30 days. And that means there's a way that we have to present ourselves, how we have to show up. And that was, for me, I had to learn that experience through that. When I was about 18 months sober, I went on this men's spiritual retreat. When I went on this retreat, I remember it was the Sunday speaker, and he was telling his story. He was talking about all the ways he tried to quit drinking. He said he tried going to church. I tried that, too. He tried shaving his head. I tried that, too. I tried listening to Tony Robbins, thinking that was going to get me sober. And for this first time in recovery, I had this belly gut laugh, like this gut level laugh. And I can just think to myself as I get in my car and I leave, and I'm just like, I finally belong somewhere. And like, nobody told me for the first 19 years of my life that the place that I belonged was at a clubhouse 10 minutes up the road. Nobody told me that this is the place where I belong, where I feel like I can be able to lay my hat in. But when I walk through these doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that my shoulders just drop because I know I'm going to be okay. My best experience I get here is that I found a home here. If you knew, I hope you find a home here too. I hope you'll be able to find a place where you're able to grow and be able to become that person that you feel like that your higher power meant for you, always meant to be. Because that's my experience here, is that I've been able to become this person that my higher power meant for me to be. And that's the joy of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just a part and a piece of this puzzle. I mean, I've been able to do some cool things, but that, like, the biggest thing has been the people I've been able to meet along the way. That's been the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to say, God bless.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is. Sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us. We walk eternally. Look into love's window for our heart. Thank you. where the promise is.